Welcome Dean and Orin Schrader up to share our chalice lighting.
This is from Philip Berrigan. According to a University of South Carolina study, violence in America rose 42% during the Vietnam War. This is hardly surprising. Our leaders are lawless, so why not we? If the government threatens other countries with the bomb, why not threaten one another with handguns? If our leaders are raping the planet, why not our neighbors? Our leaders create a climate of fear and violence. Why do they appear shocked when Americans kill, rob, and maim one another?
Okay, well, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. As I mentioned, our guest is Sean Francis Peters. And Sean is an internationally recognized expert on religious liberty issues. He's been featured by CNN, PBS, Court TV, Time Magazine, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Sean's the author of four books and has twice been recognized by the American Society of Legal Writers for an outstanding achievement. His most recent book, The Catonsville Nine, Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era, was published by Oxford University Press in 2012, and he currently teaches in the Integrated Liberal Studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I'd just like to welcome Sean this morning to speak with us.
I have my stopwatch. So, because once I get going, who knows what will happen. I apologize for that sort of pretentious sounding introduction that my publisher has put together, but the reference to CNN reminds me of the most harrowing experience I've probably ever had in my life. I'm not somebody who does stuff like that a lot. I'm not a pundit by any stretch. A few years ago, though, I was asked to appear on the Nancy Grace show, and Nancy Grace is this terrifying former prosecutor who sort of is now a cable TV talking head, and she sort of embodies the worst attributes of those two professions. And I published this book on faith healing, and it happened that kind of stuff was to do a few of these things on TV, and so she asked me to appear on the show, and she started out by saying, this is Sean Peters, he's from UW-Madison, his book is called When Prayer Fails, and I'd like to begin by saying, Mr. Peters, I think that the title of your book is completely and utterly wrong, and let me tell you why. And it kind of went downhill from there, and it was a good experience, though, because every time I have to speak somewhere or do something in public, I ask myself, is it going to be as bad as that thing that you did on Nancy Grace? And the answer is no. And certainly, being here with you in this warm and welcoming space is just fantastic. So, having said that, as was mentioned, I write about law and religion. And I'm especially interested in people who are sort of on the margins or the fringes or the peripheries of American religious experience. Those are the folks who sort of wind up interacting with state power and state authority. If you're part of a mainstream religious tradition in the United States, if you're a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian or a Methodist, at least today, the state doesn't really care very much about your beliefs and your practices. But if you're somebody on the edges, the state is going to care and perhaps try to control what you do, how you do it, when you do it, and so forth. And so I've written about the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Amish. I wrote this book about faith healing, and now I've written a book about these radical Catholic peace and social justice activists from the 1960s. That's my fourth book about that stuff, about these marginal religious people and the law, but it's actually the first story that grabbed me. It just took me a really long time to write it and kind of put it together, and I'll sort of explain that as I move forward. The Catonsville Nine were people who didn't necessarily know each other very well before they engaged in this profound and compelling act of peace and social justice activism. But they came together in May of 1968. And they were the Berrigan brothers, Daniel and Philip Berrigan. And those are probably the two names that will be most familiar to you. Dan Berrigan, still alive, 92 years old, is this sort of elfin beatnik poet Jesuit who was well known throughout the 1960s in the sort of what was known as the Catholic left. Dan Berrigan and Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton were famous. His brother Philip was very different in stature. He was a large guy. He had been an athlete as a young man, had been a paratrooper in World War II, and was a member of the Josephite religious order in Baltimore. Then there were three former Mary Knoll missionaries who had been in Guatemala for many years, basically throughout the 1960s. Tom and Marjorie Melville and a friend of theirs named John Hogan. They had just returned to the United States early in 1968, so just a few months before they did this thing in Catonsville. There was a Baltimore, I feel like I need a scorecard kind of to keep track of these nine people. Tom Lewis was an artist in Baltimore, was well known. George Missy was an activist, actually was from St. Cloud, Minnesota, but had sort of relocated to Washington, D.C. A nurse from Baltimore named Mary Moylan and a member of the Christian Brothers religious order named David Darst. And to give you an idea of how little they knew each other, obviously the Berrigans were brothers, they knew each other, Tom and Marjorie were married, but not all of them knew one another intimately. This David Darst guy showed up and he was very clean cut, he was from St. Louis, nobody knew who he was. And they got to talking about him and they said, could he be from the FBI? Could he be a plant? This is the kind of thing that they do. And he convinced them that his commitment was genuine. But that gives you an idea sort of how they came together, as often happens, I find, in life, where people just sort of common interest sort of brings folks together. So on May 17th, 1968, these nine people besieged the federal draft office in Catonsville, Maryland. Catonsville is a suburb of Baltimore just to the west. The Selective Service Office was located in the Knights of Columbus Hall in Catonsville. And yeah, that's what they said, right? That part of their mission, what they wanted to do, was highlight what they viewed as being the complicity of the Catholic hierarchy in the war effort. And they said, ooh, when they were sort of looking for places to raid, they said, ooh, this will be kind of a double whammy, right? We can attack the war and we can sort of strike at the Catholic Church as well. They went into the draft office, they seized about 375 draft records, 1A records, 1Y records, sort of a mishmash of them. They took them out behind the hall and set them on fire. They had brought with them napalm that they had made. And for those of us in Madison, right, for those of you who remember the occupation of the Commerce Building and the protest against Dow Chemical, right? The reason that people didn't like Dow Chemical because Dow made napalm, right? And napalm was this emblem of the savagery and barbarity of the war in Southeast Asia. It turns out that napalm is really easy to make. Gasoline and soap flakes, that's what you need, bathtub chemistry. They had made some of that, brought it with them, doused the records, set the records on fire, said some prayers, made some statements, and then basically waited to be arrested. At that point, they didn't want to evade the authorities at all. It was going to be an act of civil disobedience, and the federal government obliged them, was very happy to lock them up and charge them with a variety of crimes, including interference with the Selective Service Act and destruction of federal property. They're put on trial in Baltimore in the fall of 1968, right? And 1968 is this year where all sorts of amazing, tragic things. You have the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, the Democratic Convention in Chicago. I would put the trial of the Kingsville Nine up there in terms of dramatic moments. It is this fantastic forum about not only the war, but America's place in the world and morality and one's, you know, commitment to peace and social justice activism. They are very, very guilty in terms of the letter of the law. Everybody knows that they have done what the government has charged them with doing. It is on film. They show the film of them committing the crime at the trial. And they get up and they freely admit it, but their goal is to kind of put the war on trial and to more broadly sort of have a very public conversation about peace, race, capitalism, all of these things sort of coming together. The sort of apogee of the trial, the most famous moment of the trial, happens after the jury retires. Dan Berrigan says, well, if you, Judge, if you don't mind, my friends and I would like to say the Lord's Prayer. Do you think that that would be okay? And the judge sort of looks at the prosecutor and says, nothing in my legal training has prepared me for this. They want to end this federal trial with this prayer, and everyone goes along. And I'll go out on a limb and say that no other federal trial in American history has ended with the Our Father. Unfortunately for the Nine, the trial also ends with them being found guilty. And oftentimes, that is where people's understanding of the story ends. And for me, in writing this book, I was interested in sort of a lot of the stuff that happened after that, because I thought it was cool. Four of the Nine went underground. They decided that they weren't going to submit to the authority of the state. So the Berrigans, George Mishy, and Mary Moreland didn't show up when it was their time to report for prison. Dan Berrigan, throughout the summer of 1970, just taunted J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. He would actually show up at places like this on a Sunday morning, right? He's a fugitive from justice. He shows up, will give a speech, and basically say, ha-ha, catch me if you can. Eventually, he is caught. The three men are all caught in 1970, but the woman, Mary Moreland, stays underground for 9 years. She turns herself in 1979, and purely on her own accord. She's never really caught. This is a story that, as a legal historian, most historians of the period know about. It has a personal resonance for me because I'm from Catonsville, Maryland. I was raised as a Catholic. I went to church right around the corner from the Knights of Columbus Hall. I went to school right around the corner from the Knights of Columbus Hall. The Knights of Columbus Hall, where all of this took place, is actually, it functions as an informal town hall in Catonsville. I've been in there many times. My 25th high school reunion was in the banquet hall of the Knights of Columbus in Catonsville. And as I grew up, I felt a connection to this story. I kept hearing about it, these, you know, crazy Catholics and what they had done. It's really the most famous thing that had ever happened in our town. And I played baseball for Catonsville. I went to Catonsville High School. And as you might know, you know, baseball teams are referred to as the Nine. You know, in case of the bat, it's like the Mudville Nine. So we would be referred to as the Catonsville Nine, and that was my dad's favorite joke. It would be, you know, Peters leads Catonsville Nine over Pikesville. And my dad would say, yeah, way to go, you and your radical friends. It also, what grabbed me about this story too, what it was just so unusual that you would have Catholic clergy and lay people taking such a drastic step. And that really appealed to me. I was kind of a mischievous kid, and I thought, well, this must be interesting, right? If this is so controversial, I must know more about it. And two, I was interested in that people had such different views about the Catonsville Nine. Many people valorized them and spoke of them as being these living saints, and honored them whenever they could, spoke very highly of them. And then there were people who thought that the Catonsville Nine were traitors, that they had betrayed their country and their church, right, by siding with the enemy during a time of war. And then there were people kind of in the middle who were friends of the Catonsville Nine, who liked them, but sort of questioned their tactics. When they went into the draft office, you know, people worked in offices, and there were these three older women there, and to grab the records, they sort of had to mildly rough up these women, shove them aside, and of course they set these records on fire. And for many people, that's not the same thing as going to Woolworths and sitting at the lunch counter and waiting to be arrested. So Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, other people sort of said, we agree with your goals, but not necessarily with your methods. And for me, I like complexity, I like ambiguity. It's pretty easy to write hagiography, to just say, these people were heroes. This is a litany of all of the awesome things that they've done, and they wore white hats and their enemies wore black hats. For me, that's really boring. I like complexity and sort of understanding the variety of motivations and responses that people have. So I was gripped by this story and I started piecing it together, and really over a period of about 30 years. That doesn't mean I like stayed in my basement for 30 years and wrote this book. I did other things, I went to school, I wrote other books, I had kids. But I collected information, I mean, dating back to when I was in elementary and junior high school. And I did the stuff that journalists and historians do. I interviewed people, collected documents, I filed requests with the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act. I got this giant, you know, pile of materials. And eventually, I did that, you know, like the sausage grinder thing where you put it all in and then something comes out and you hope that it's edible. And I produced this book. It's 178,000 words. There are 1,200 footnotes. I won't pretend to tell you everything that's in there. I'll just highlight a couple of things really quickly in the next 5 minutes. And most importantly, the thing that I stress whenever I talk about the Catonsville Nine is that the Catonsville Nine and the action on May 17th, 1968 was not strictly about Vietnam. When we talk about the 60s, when people like me teach the 1960s, we sort of break it up into these chunks. We talk about the civil rights movement here, and then we talk about the anti-war movement here, and then we talk about maybe feminism here, sort of at the tail end. And for those of you who went through it, I'm sure that you did not view those things in that manner, right? They were sort of all of a piece in terms of how you viewed the world and how you viewed your sort of ethical obligations to your fellow man, and that is exactly the way the Catonsville Nine themselves were. They went to Catonsville to offer kind of a broad and complex critique of American society, and for them, Vietnam was merely the most egregious symptom of a disease that was afflicting the entire body politic of America. When I looked at the Unitarian Universalist affirmation that Penny sent to me to refresh my memory, the stress on justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, the goal of world peace, liberty, and justice for all is exactly what the Catonsville Nine was about. So not only was it not about Vietnam, it wasn't necessarily about Catholicism either. It very much transcended the Catholic tradition. The fact that all nine of them were Catholics, it wasn't entirely coincidental, but it could have turned out differently. There could have been people from other religious traditions as well. And even within the realm of foreign relations, they cared about Vietnam, but three of the nine had lived in Guatemala throughout the 1960s. And Guatemala in the 60s and in the 50s is this story of American intervention, right? We sort of backed the assassination of the democratically elected leader of Guatemala in 1954. Then we backed the oligarchy and the United Fruit Company in the 1960s. For three of the nine, Guatemala was actually much more in the forefront than Vietnam as well. And if you look at the statement that they issued at the time of their protest, there's all this stuff about Guatemala. When people talk about the Nine today, they almost never mention the Guatemala piece as well. But actually for me, as I got into it, I found that to be really interesting as well. Another thing quickly, you know, here I am, and I started by talking about the Berrigans, and oftentimes the story is told as like the Berrigans and the Seven Dwarves, at least two heroes, superstars, and then there's all these other people. And to go back to the UU affirmation stresses the inherent worth and dignity of every person. In writing this book, I was really interested in those other seven people. The story of the Berrigans has been told really, really well by lots of other people. But the story of those other seven has not, right? And I mentioned that I like marginal people on the periphery. So even in my story of marginal people, I actually looked for the marginal people within the marginal people. Mary Moylan and David Darst, in particular, they had stories that were especially illuminating and tragic as well. Mary Moylan's time underground was a time of intense emotional turmoil for her. David Darst, he died in an automobile accident, had been experiencing profound depression as well. I wanted to tell that story too, not just hero priests, but the totality of it. I also found myself wanting to talk about as many people as possible. You know, this book is sort of a nine-person group biography, which is complicated enough. But then I kept meeting these other people who I found were really interesting too. William Kunstler was their attorney. William Kunstler was this fascinating, dynamic, iconoclastic lawyer. And even Jimmy Hoffa appears in this book. When Phil Berrigan and a few of the other members of the Nine were in Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania in the early 1970s. Well, Jimmy Hoffa was there, and he kind of ran the joint. Jimmy Hoffa was Catholic. And there was this incredible, like, summit meeting between Phil Berrigan and Jimmy Hoffa in prison. And as a writer, it's really the hardest thing, right, is that you have a story to tell, and then you sort of say, I can't not tell that story. It's so cool. I must do it. So whether I did that successfully or not, I don't know. And the other thing is, like, when do you stop with all of these stories? You know, when do you know that your book is over, which is complicated? Sometimes it's never over. If you've ever tried to write a dissertation or you advise somebody, sometimes people don't know when to end it. I knew it was time to end it when I was writing about Tom Melville in prison in 1970, and he wrote a letter about having hemorrhoids and how he couldn't drive a tractor anymore. He needed to have some other job on the prison farm. And I said, okay, I'm done. If I know this level of detail, then I'm finished. I'll wrap up. I won't talk forever, and maybe we can have some discussion as well. I get asked a lot, you know, why did you write this book now, and sort of what lesson does it have for the present? And I resist maybe some of the part of the premise of that question, because I think sometimes people believe that you can sort of mechanistically apply history's lessons, and if you do it the right way, it'll have a particular laudatory result. And that doesn't really usually happen, right? We're actually terrible about, for as much as we talk about learning from the past, we don't actually do it very well. I think a better question might be, how can this narrative be used, and by whom, and sort of to what end? And that's what I would encourage you to do with all of these stories, not just the one I've been talking to you about today, you know, to be inspired by them or to be skeptical of them, but to at least engage them in a meaningful way. So, thank you. I'm on 2 minutes over.
Stay here. Okay. Yep. We have some time for discussion, so Peter will go around with the microphone, and we'll kind of make a call.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, just cut me
awesome.
Off.
And I'll, just go ahead and keep your questions and comments right. brief. That way, more people can share today.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's the one of the interesting things about writing about Catholicism is the hierarchy and the, you know, the official Catholic Church, and then there's kind of the lived Catholic Church, and you can pick an era. Sometimes people talk about, you know, everything changed after Vatican II, and that's true to a point, but there had been that kind of bifurcation before Vatican II, and so you can absolutely, that's something that is, it's germane to all of these issues. I teach in the Integrated Liberal Studies program, and ILS is a multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary humanities program. It's a long story. I don't really narrowly teach this stuff. I teach a course called Narratives of Justice and Equality in Multicultural America. And I teach another course called Remix and Appropriation. I also work for in the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement. So I work for the Chief Diversity Officer. In Catonsville and its environs, there are lots of people. The Nine told me this, and I heard that people would come up to them and say, "Thank you so much. You burned my draft record, and that meant I didn't go."
Wow.
Okay. you know Woodstock, right? And if everybody who said they had been to Woodstock actually had been to Woodstock, 6 million people. It certainly delayed the induction of those specific people whose files were burned. But there were enough records kept separately that most of those files were reconstructed. And you know, I'll say 375 guys, they just found 375 other guys from some other draft board and kind of plug them in. And it's a much broader question of what did it matter? You know, what did it matter at all? The Nine wanted there to be, they wanted to sort of light a fire that would spread, and they wanted draft boards throughout the country to be attacked. In Milwaukee, the Milwaukee 14, later in 1968, that was a fire. That was 10,000 draft records. The Nine hoped that they would not only have a practical effect, but also a symbolic effect as well. It's very debatable. It certainly did not help to expedite the draft at all. I don't know that it saved literally any one specific person. If it saved one person, it just meant that another person substituted. And that doesn't mean that it wasn't meaningful or it didn't have an impact. But, you know, they didn't just coincidentally choose to burn the records. They thought about symbolically. There'd been an earlier action that Phil Berrigan had participated in where they poured blood on some records in downtown Baltimore. People sort of didn't get the symbolism, so they used fire to evoke the Pentecost, for instance, as well. And they thought through, you know, Tom Lewis, one of the Nine, was an artist. He said some really interesting things about the protest as a performance and as a work of art. To go to your point about violence, I mean, I think that their argument is the certainly Phil said the most about this, that, you know, some property doesn't deserve to exist. And that if you were in, the comparison that they drew at trial over and over again was Nazi Germany. And if you were, if you came across, you know, the ovens of Auschwitz, right? What is the proper response to that object, you know? And is it truly, does it violate the tenets of nonviolence to destroy an object that is part of this machinery of death? And I find that to be a very persuasive act. I'm less persuaded by what they did to the women in the draft office. That was sort of mild physical violence and was regrettable, and that's sort of a separate issue as well. But I think that's, to go to your point, yeah, it needed to be a spectacular symbolic thing, and they understood that. For it to capture attention. I mean, this was a big deal. It was on national TV. They knew about it in the Kremlin. You know, all over the world, people knew what this was. And so they understood the power of the event itself. And with plowshares and, you know, King of Prussia, the plowshares event there too as well. that it was, there's a performative symbolic aspect of that that is really crucial to what they did and was part of the reason that so many people were inspired by them. I don't know that a prayer vigil, and I don't want to dismiss prayer vigils, but if they had just, you know, read the Psalms outside of this draft office, I don't think that I would be here talking about it. And they were frustrated throughout the 60s. Phil Berrigan was really the most, he said, we're writing these letters and we're praying and we're marching and nothing is happening. It doesn't have any effect. This machinery of death just continues. So we have to do something serious. And I think that they, if they had burned down the building, that's one thing. I think it's another thing to take the records out and in a ceremonial fire. They picked napalm specifically for that reason too. So it was all very, very well articulated and thought through. Everything that they did, all the time. Sure. I have a Joe Elder story. I don't think it was a performance of the play, The Trial of the Catonsville Nine. I think it was some other play. Joe Elder played Phil Berrigan in Madison. So, yeah. Well, and that was another reason why some people questioned what they did. Some people said true civil disobedience means submitting to state authority, and that was a matter of controversy among their supporters as well. I think those four people said things have changed. Between May of 1968 and the spring of 1970, which is when they needed to report for prison, they said, this is genocide, what's happening in Southeast Asia, and so that we need to break with the norms of civil disobedience or maybe change the norms of civil disobedience and witness outside of prison in a way that will be meaningful. Clearly, they didn't all agree with themselves. Five of them, or David Darst had died by then, four of them reported and four of them did not. John Hogan, who's one of the nine, basically said, okay, I'm done. I'm just going to prison. I want to get it over with. I did what I said I was going to do, and I'm going to move on. And then you had Dan Berrigan, who said, what I can do is appear at rallies, appear at religious services, and that if I really want to stop this genocide, what I really need to do is not be bound by the norms of civil disobedience. What I need to do today, the most meaningful thing I can do today, is to resist. And that was a decision that they all made individually. They got together and they had a meeting and they said, we're going to do our own thing. And they were at peace. The people who went to prison immediately were at peace. You know, the Melvilles were married. And they said, they had met as priest and nun, they got married. And then they wound up, and they were like, okay, we want to get this over with because we're in love and we want to, be together. And so they went to prison right away to get it over with. But that's a good question too. And I'll stick around after too if anybody wants to talk more about it.
Our closing words today are from Robert Heinlein. A society that gets rid of all its troublemakers goes downhill. Thanks everybody for coming today. Please extend the hand of friendship and a warm fuzzy to those around you. And please join us for coffee and conversation. Thank you.